And as you know, we're talking in this law symposium about disabilities and other characteristics that identify populations that we have come to regard as diverse in our society, and the intersections that occur there. It has been a wish of mine expressed at more than one of these symposia that we find a way to get more of our colleagues on the bench. It is a pleasure for us to have a United States District Judge to make our keynote today, who is from the District Court for the Middle District of Alabama. He was nominated by President Carter, which shows you some about his legal career, and confirmed by the Senate in 1980. He was at the time the youngest member of the federal judiciary, the second African American appointed to be a federal judge in Alabama. He served as chief judge from 1991 to 1998. He became the first African American United States District Court chief judge in Alabama. Before he was appointed to the bench, he was the first African American Assistant Attorney General in the state of Alabama. He served there for 2 years and then began a private practice. His firm handled labor law, civil rights, school desegregation, sex discrimination, and First Amendment matters. He is the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2015 National Public Service Award from the John and Jerry Levin Center for Public Service and Public Interest Law at Stanford Law School, the 2013 Thurgood Marshall Award from the National Bar Association's Judicial Council, the 2008 Judge Jane Bolin Service Award from the Yale Law School Black Law Students Association, the 2005 Mark DeWolf Howe Award from the Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review for his unyielding commitment to advancing the personal freedoms and human dignities of the American people. He received his undergraduate degree from Yale University and his law degree from the same institution. It is a joy and an honor to present to you Judge Myron Thompson.
Thank you, Dr. Maurer, for having me here today. While I am from Alabama, in fact, Montgomery, Alabama, I just flew in yesterday from San Francisco, where I was on a three-judge panel that judged a moot court competition at Berkeley Law School. That was on Tuesday. And I had already accepted the Berkeley Law invitation when I received Mr. Riccobono's invitation to speak to you here today on Thursday of the same week. Because the two events were on only 2 days apart, and because the two events were split, one was on one coast and one was on the other coast, I would typically have declined the invitation to speak to you here today, mainly because I just wouldn't have had the energy to do it. But I couldn't. This was a defining event for me, and it was really a defining invitation. Never before had someone extended an invitation to me and unabashedly and unapologetically given as one of the reasons for inviting me that, and this is the quote, that I am an African-American judge with a disability. End of quote. To this invitation, despite the great inconvenience, I just, Nancy Reagan's going to turn over in a grave, but I just couldn't say no. Instead, in fact, if I were to give a reason for why I'm here today, it would be to, if I were to give a title to my remarks here today, it would be, why am I here today? To do this, let me begin with the tale of Esau. This is not a biblical tale. I'm not a minister. I'm not going to put you to sleep with a sermon, so you can rest easy. And in fact, this is a tale about Mrs. Esau. And to me, Mrs. Esau was this elderly woman. At least she appeared to be elderly when I knew her, for I was only about 12 or 13. She lived across the street from me in a town called Tuskegee, Alabama, where the famous Tuskegee Institute was, founded by Booker T. Washington. My stepfather was a minister when I was growing up, and indeed was the field secretary for the NAACP, which was the same position, if you remember, that Medgar Evers, who was assassinated in Mississippi, held, of course, in Mississippi. And both my stepfather and my mother were deeply involved in the civil rights movement, and in particular in the fight to obtain the right to vote. Well, when my parents were otherwise engaged with their activities, they would send me to stay with Mrs. Esau. She had married late in life, had no children, and I rather think that to the extent that she viewed herself as having a child, I was that child. And quite often she would, in addition to taking care of me while my parents, as I said, were otherwise engaged, she would ask my parents to take me on Saturdays to go with her on errands. Now, she drove this huge, big, black Cadillac. I mean, it was so huge that I would wonder how she could get around in it because she was a little lady. She was only about that tall. She could barely see over the steering wheel, and I don't know how she ever reached the gas pedal, and even more so how she ever reached the brake. But she did, and I think the only reason my parents had no fear of my riding with her was the fact that that car was so big that we would demolish anything we hit. But I would sit next to her in the car, and we would talk. And we would go around on her errands, and I grew to love her. I mean, she was a big part of my childhood. Well, on one Saturday, she told me she had to go see a doctor. And I asked her, and I said, "What's the problem, Mrs. Esau?" And she said, "No, no big problem. I just have a doctor's appointment." And when I was growing up, Tuskegee was one of the, perhaps the only community in Alabama that had a black hospital. In fact, I had spent most of my childhood in the polio wing of that hospital. I had polio and had surgeries there and had numerous days of the week having therapy at that hospital. And the hospital, because it was the sort of the center, especially, in fact, for black kids who had polio, it was actually had a national reputation. Some of the doctors there would go around giving speeches because it had such a concentration of polio victims. And the doctors had done all these things in trying to work with these kids. And then also the hospital just had a concentration of black doctors, from all over the country who would come and work there. And in fact, the black doctor who delivered me and all the other black babies in our community was viewed as a god. So when Ms. Lisaw said, "I'm going to see a doctor," I said, "Well, when are you going to go to John Andrews?" She says, I know the doctors there, and I'll go with you." And she said, John Andrews being the hospital, the black hospital. And Ms. Esau said, "I don't go to black doctors, and I don't go to black lawyers. They're not as good as white ones." I don't think I responded to that, because I was only 12 or 13. You know, when you're 12 or 13 and you're talking to adults, at least back then, you called everyone Mr. and Mrs. You didn't call people by their first name, so I never called her Lottie. I called her Mrs. Esau, even though she was very close to me. It was like a sponge. I just absorbed all this and thought about it. But there's no question that it had an impact on me, because I went and told my parents about it, in particular my mom. I said, "Mom, you know, Ms. Esau says that black doctors aren't very good." And my mom's only response was, "Oh, that's Lottie." That was her first name. I'd also known that in other areas of Alabama, and particularly where my mother's folks lived in Dothan, a little town in southeast Alabama, when my grandmother had been ill, if you were black and you went to the hospital, you were put in the basement because the hospital was segregated. All the black patients were in the basement. And I'd heard tales about how some doctors would not touch black patients, and how some nurses refused to touch black patients. And in fact, my grandfather had taken my grandmother to Vanderbilt University because he could not stand the treatment she was getting in the hospital in Dothan, and the fact that she was getting such second-rate treatment. At 12 or 13, I was old enough to at least realize that Ms. Esau considered all black people inferior and considered all black people not worthy of treatment with dignity. This also meant that she considered herself inferior, and that she would subject herself to this inferior treatment also meant that she was not worthy of being treated with dignity. I sometimes think that the indignity that she internalized with that comment was worse than any indignity she suffered outwardly by being denied the right to vote or being segregated. You know, you can redress outward indignities. You can, you know, go and demonstrate. You can eventually let people know you need the right to vote or you don't want separate but equal. But how do you redress when a human spirit is destroyed? My mother's only response when I told her what Ms. Esau said was, "Oh, that's Lottie." In other words, there's very little we could do about that. Not until years later did I realize that Ms. Esau and I shared more than I thought. For like her, I had internalized my own shame and my own indignity. It was a disability. For her, it was race. For me, it was the disability itself. I went through 7 years of Yale being a judge for decades, high school, and not once did anyone mention the fact that I had a limp, or when I went swimming that I appeared different when I was without my clothes, or that I had scars from surgeries. It was unmentioned. It was unacknowledged by them, and perhaps more tragically, it was unacknowledged by me. In a way, I lived, as gay people would say, in a closet, but mine was a glass closet, but nonetheless a closet. Mine you could see, but it still meant that I was kept inside. When Dr. King would talk in private, Dr. Martin Luther King would talk in private, about why he engaged in public demonstrations, he would usually give the first reason, which is to appeal to the public conscience. But in private, he would add another reason, which was to demonstrate to all the black people out there that they are worthy of dignity. His public demonstrations were aimed at Mrs. Esau and all the Mrs. Esaus in the world who internalized their own second-class citizenship. A few years back, I had lunch, or actually dinner, with some friends, and it was with, they were setting up a special sort of opportunity for me to meet with Judge Tatel, an incredibly well-recognized federal judge. During the conversation, I asked Judge Tatel in so many words, and I don't remember my exact words, what was it like to be blind? He answered my question, and then we engaged in a sort of a proposed conversation about how people react to disabilities in this country. Afterwards, the people who had hosted the dinner, and one of them was taking me home, said, "I cannot believe you did that." And I said, "What?" No one ever asked Judge Tatel about the fact that he is blind. It is beyond conversation. It was the no-no question for everyone. And I said, "Well, no one told me." And I said, "As far as I could tell, he answered my question. It was a quite enjoyable evening. His wife was there, and we even talked about it from her perspective." And I recently saw on another program where Judge Tatel had come out, and he was talking about his own disability. At this conference, I see where you're going to talk a lot about outward barriers that the disabled face. I ask you also to consider what I consider inward barriers. Barriers that are in some ways more difficult because they are elusive, because they're less concrete, and because sometimes you never know whether you've eliminated them or not. Relatively speaking, it's easy to, you know, build an incline for a wheelchair. It's easy to increase the size of a doorway. It is much more difficult to redress a human spirit that has been led to believe that it is not normal and that it is less worthy of dignity. I was thinking in my own career as a judge, how perhaps I myself have been guilty of not recognizing full dignity. For a number of years, I ruled on a case presided over a case called Wyatt versus Stickney, which involved the state mental health system. Halfway through that case, at a conference, I don't know whether I did it or someone else did it, but someone said to the plaintiff's lawyers, "Who are your clients?" The plaintiff's lawyers said, "We don't know." I said, "Well, when was the last time you talked to one of your clients?" They had not. In fact, when Judge Johnson, who was the original judge on the case, certified the class, he issued one line that said, "Class certified," and Wyatt was the plaintiff, and Wyatt had long left. Here was a case that was being decided essentially based on what the lawyers were saying, what the doctors in the institutions were saying, what everybody on earth was saying about the people on whose behalf the case was brought. I recertified the case and I said, "You find me some plaintiffs, some people who can speak on behalf of the people who are affected." And it was not only to make sure that the court was informed of the people affected, it was because by not hearing from them, we essentially were telling them that they were not worthy of being heard. That's a killing of the spirit. Now, many of them probably had to speak through guardians. Many of them may not have been able to say directly what was in their best interest. But there were some mentally ill people who could tell me exactly what was wrong. Not all of them were incapable of communicating with the court. And in that sense, the court as well as the lawyers were essentially viewing them as not worthy of being heard. And by saying that they're not worthy of being heard, we were saying to them that they're not worthy. Another case I had was Lee versus Macon, which was the big school desegregation case. And again, I had some lawyers come before me, and I asked them, where are your clients? And this aspect of the case actually dealt with the fact that most black kids in Alabama were being funneled into special education programs, and as a result, were essentially resegregating kids. The black kids went into the special education programs. The white kids went into the normal programs, if not the the programs for kids who were gifted. And the determination as to whether these kids went into these programs was purely a subjective determination by the teachers. No testing. And you can guess that virtually all the black kids were in special education. And to make matters worse, they were being warehoused in special education. They would send them to the gym. And if they had any type of problems, conduct problems, they were expelled. And so we made that a statewide class action. They eventually settled it and set up criteria that would only make sure that kids who really were worthy of special education got it, and secondly, that the kids who got special education got education. But nonetheless, also it was critical that the people who were affected, their parents, the kids, be heard from. You know, I was thinking about when I was making my remarks today and growing up, as I said, with a disability, and I've often been curious, and I'm a movie buff. I'm an incredible movie buff. And one of my favorite movies is The Usual Suspects. And I don't know if many of you have looked at it from the perspective of someone who's disabled. It's like looking at a movie from the perspective of someone who's black, or looking at a movie from the perspective of someone who's Jewish. You catch all of the underlying stuff, you know, that's directed at your group. And that's a great line in The Usual Suspects when Kevin Spacey is, you know, he's the demon, he's the bad guy, and yet everybody thinks that he's okay. In fact, everyone thinks he is not even worthy of being considered. He's invisible. And what they do and what he does is he's a cripple. And in fact, the main guy says, the police officer says, "You're stupid, verbal. But you're a cripple. Because you're a cripple, you're weak." And so they could not perceive of him as actually being the mastermind. You know, and throughout literature, when you think of, the evil nurse Diesel, they put a hump on her back, which makes her evil. Or, Frankenstein, you put a hump on your back to make you evil. In other words, if you're crippled outside, you're crippled inside. And those metaphors permeate literature. I'm not saying that, you know, that movies and literature are not fair game, but I also think we have to be sensitive to stereotyping disabled people just like we're sensitive to stereotyping black people or gay people. And knowing that, you know, sometimes you can overdo it, and the fact that you're crippled doesn't mean. People used to say that I had braces on my legs meant I had braces on my brains, and I remember that. And when I was born, my grandfather said, "Oh my God!" When I was born, kids. You have to remember this too. If you have small kids, kids hear everything. You might think they don't hear it, and sometimes they even hear you when you're not talking. And the words I got were, you know, "We've got a kid who's paralyzed, he has polio, and we're going to have to take care of him for the rest of his life." That was the message I got from my own family. And you've got to be careful not to say that to your kids, either through your actions or your words. Because what you can do is you can cripple their insides, too. But I think the important point is to make sure that everyone feels that he or she is deserving of dignity in this world and in your own families themselves. And I'll even point the finger even more homeward. I did a study First of all, I went to Pace Law School about 4 years ago, and I was walking around the clinical program, and I came across a disabilities law clinic. And I said, "Do you all have a disabilities law clinic here at Pace?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "I had never heard of that." So I did a study of what schools have disabilities law clinics. Yale does not have a disabilities law clinic. Yale does not have a course that has disabilities in its title. Harvard does not have a disabilities law clinic. Stanford, where I went to a year and a half ago and visited them and said, "Where is your disabilities law clinic?" They do not have a disabilities law clinic. Now, some of them, like Harvard, will have a veterans law clinic. Some will have a social securities law clinic. I'm not knocking that. Don't get me wrong. It's just not enough. Columbia does not have a disabilities law clinic. Berkeley, where I just came from, does not have a disabilities law clinic. They all have LGBT law clinics. They all have immigration law clinics. Well, why aren't we worthy of that? And that's what I discovered. Now, I know I have some former law clerks here from Yale and from Columbia, and I know that there are others here from Harvard whom I met earlier, but we got a lot of work to do in our own backyard, in our own schools, to let them know that disabilities people are worthy of, we're just as sexy as immigration clinics. We're just as sexy as LGBT clinics. And it's us to do it. You know, and I when I go around, I ask that question. I'm a judge. I can do it. Now, I have to admit, I'm new to the party, and I'm late to the party. But you know, they say better, as my son used to say when he didn't do his work, better late than never. You know, I haven't talked about, I know some of the substantive issues that you're going to talk about in your various fallout groups. Things like, you know, the poor black mother who has to take off from work to deal with a disabled child. I know what that's like. My mother, before she married my stepfather, was a single mother, and she spent many of her weekdays carrying me for treatment. I know that firsthand, but I thought you'd deal with that nonetheless in your other programs. And I also know that there are issues within the disabilities community about, you know, do you call someone a disabled person, or do you call someone a person who has a disability? Well, for those of you who think that disagreement is bad, let me assure you that if you're not stepping on toes, if you're not engaged in heated debate over where you should be going, then you're not doing anything. I lived through the civil rights period of the 60s and 70s, and there were no more heated debates as to whether Dr. King was right or wrong. And there were many who said he was wrong, including my own stepfather at times. But unless the debate is heated, you're not adding anything. You've got to be engaged in hot debate. I'm going to close with a crib from Dr. Tenbrook, who basically said, and that's all I'm really saying here today when I'm asking you to remember as you go out, to engage in both the external, and for me, I hope I've emphasized the internal barriers that we as a disabled face. And that means having disabled people on your panels when you talk about the disabled. If you're going to talk about black people, have black people on the panel. If you're going to talk about women, have women on the panel. If you're going to talk about gays, have gays on the panel. If you're going to talk about the disabled, have the disabled on the panel. And what that means in Dr. Tenbrook's comments "You're preparing people to live in the world." Those are his quotes. That's a real challenge, and thank you very much.
Judge,